All of this is in the future when the words of the Lord's Prayer shall become manifest. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. If there is to be heaven on this earth, then it is natural to assume that there will be no place on this planet for the obstructionists, the unlighted ones who are haunted by doubt, fear, hate and greed. This book is therefore of interest only to those who know in their hearts that they truly desire to serve the light, that, as such servers, they really wish to take part in the unfoldment of the divine plan on this planet. We need not waste time and energy trying to convince the unlighted ones that God is a good God. If they have not figured that out in the past, it is hardly likely that they will learn to lovingly entertain the idea during the future. Therefore, only those who are interested in taking part in ushering in the new civilization should read this book. Among those bent on vengeance, war, financial profit, and so forth, this book will only arouse further antagonism and jealousy. Where their future lies is a matter of no interest to us, whatsoever. Those who are not with God are against Him, and that settles the matter. Our entire energy now must be thrown on the positive side. We must study the situation as of today, find out just where we stand, discover what progress has been made, and what remains to be done. How can we help? What positive enterprises, no matter how tiny or how great, can we initiate? Even now, like Noah of old, we gaze expectantly skyward, knowing that the dove is winging its way from outer space, bearing to us the symbolic olive branch from our planetary neighbors, those good friends we knew and loved so well. They are coming again. Now let us prepare for the great reunion of fellowship, of interplanetary friendship. Let us prepare to welcome the dove and send forth to all mankind the joyous message of goodwill to all. Chapter 2. The Earth is being drenched with the cosmic ray, coming in from outer space, and focused upon this planet by beamed direction from certain other planets and stars, which serve as great reservoirs for this cosmic energy. At the very center of the Earth, certain rays carrying certain colors meet, forming the polarities and axis. This central orb or kingdom formed by the rays is under divine law. In this central orb, the rays and colors are blended, and now, they constantly surge up and through the Earth, washing over every single atom that makes up the globe, including mankind. In olden times, the Earth was known to be one of God's many mansions, as are all planets and stars. The center of the Earth was regarded as the central altar of the planet, upon which eternally blazed the sacred flame. The light from this reflected to and through every atom. Perhaps in time, this reflection will cleanse the soil of all strontium poisoning resulting from nuclear test fallouts. The strontium was released by stupid and misguided men, dedicated to deeds of violence. One, the tests are still blasting away, making more work for the cosmic ray. Mankind does these foolish things. Instead of considering the one God, we find men and women everywhere, running helplessly and hopelessly in pursuit of the many things which they think will increase their happiness. Yet, they wonder why they continue to suffer. Mistake on top of mistake. They never appear to learn. They wonder why they must endure a twilight existence only to face death as a finality. The answer is that they judge by appearances. Because the majority of people are troubled, they rashly assume that trouble is inevitable. Because the majority of people die, they rashly assume that death is a normal and natural change. Because the majority of people are often angry, hostile, aggravated people, full of hate and misery, this condition is accepted as the rule for all mankind on this earth. It is, they say, the way the ball bounces. But during the next 2,000 years, all these delusions will be dispelled. As soon as the people from other planets are received in friendship, we will quickly realize that we, as Earth people, and as very, very stupid people, are much in the minority in this solar system. We will quickly realize that trouble is not a natural or normal condition for us. Trouble is an atheistic condition, brought on by the Earth people who have lost contact with their Maker, lost faith in Him, and therefore have lost all knowledge of how to live as we should. Without God in our hearts, we poison the soil, the atmosphere and our own bodies with hate, openly inviting disease, disaster and death. If, as we pretend to believe, God is good and perfect, and man is made in his image and likeness even to being endowed with a free will, then why should imperfection be accepted? We were told to be perfect, even as our Father in heaven is perfect. We should busy ourselves calling forth perfection, impressing it upon suffering matter, so that the matter can send forth the radiant energy of love rather than a vibration of pain. Man has misused his free will, has misspent his God-given energy, and has filled the earth with monstrous miscreations entirely of his own making. Because he has been willing to accept imperfection, he has not asked for help from his ever-present Maker, but has gone ahead on his own, trying constantly to improve his lot by exchanging one imperfection for another which he hopes will prove slightly less imperfect. Man has attempted to build entire complex civilizations by using judgment based on appearances. Now science comes forward, following the power, crazed war machine in a frenzied pace to keep us with things as they appear to be and as the misguided scientists and politicians think things ought to be. The bewildered public is told that this is progress. Exactly since when has progress been based on fear, the one and only weapon available to the dark forces? So while the dark forces entrenched in science are busy creating imperfect systems to bolster up already imperfect systems, our hearts need not be troubled. We can turn abruptly from this negative point of view and look upon the positive surge toward perfection which is now rapidly engulfing the human family. We can happily see now how the whole world of appearances will vanish within the transmuting power of the cosmic ray, which is now almost upon us. It might appear that little has been accomplished during the past 2,000 years, but remember what Jesus said. Let not your heart be troubled. The most outstanding opportunity before us now lies in our acceptance of the hand of friendship extended to us by our neighbors from other lands and other planets in our solar system. The great message of truth that the Venusians and others wish to convey to us today is identical with the universal truth established by Jesus. As soon as interplanetary communication is established on a world-wide scale, the Earth people will quickly realize that they have been foolish to have wasted their time and money listening to so-called authorities, who have sold their lies at a high price. The truth has always been free. No one can purchase it, for it only comes directly from the one God through his one divine Son Jesus. This has been the message from Venus, from the first visit. They are still sending the same old, but very new, message. The good news which Christ tried to teach us sets us free. What is this freedom? Freedom for man comes to him as a result of his using God, free energy in its natural free way. God, energy in its pure form flows into man heartbeat by heartbeat, as the pure electrons are released by the sacred three-fold flame within the heart. They enter the bloodstream. As they enter, they are immediately qualified or stamped with the pattern of the individual. They can be qualified with love or they can be misqualified with hate. In other words, the electrons, which provide all power, can be used to carry out loving deeds, to think loving thoughts, to speak loving words, or they can be used in an opposite manner, depending upon the choice we make through the use of our free will. When man misuses this electronic power in performing hateful acts, he misqualifies the energy. In other words, he leaves his stamp of imperfection upon millions of electrons that flow into his bloodstream. This energy is God energy, and as such it must obey the free will of man, for man is the reflection of God, created as a free being. When man chooses to enslave this free and pure energy, so that it will do his bidding and supply him with power to carry out some questionable enterprise, he thereby enslaves himself. He starts each pure electron on its way through his own bloodstream with a handicap, the weight of his own feeling of discord. The electron itself remains pure, for it is God, energy, and can know no impurity. But as it whirls o'er its course, it collects around itself a shell of impure matter, the same murky gray astral matter that the laggards brought to Earth. as it takes its appointed place with other electrons and forms an atom, the sticky substance clings, and soon the revolution of the electrons within the atom is slowed by clogging. Then the revolution of the atom itself is slowed, and in addition, the atom collects the same astral substance on its outer shell, adding further weight. Part 3, Chapter 2. The resulting rate of electronic revolutions, plus atomic taken as a whole in a man's physical, etheric, emotional and mental bodies, constitute what is known as his state of consciousness or his vibratory note. If his electrons and atoms are evolving slowly, he is not only subject to disease, but he is subject to ugly delusions such as death. He begins to feel old age creeping on, and in his limited understanding, he assumes that death is not far away. He feels fearful, bereft and alone. He cannot understand who he is or why he is here. He has no purpose in accord with the divine plan. He is, in short, a materialist, weighted down by his own burdens of hate which he carries right within his own atoms. He tends to be separative in relation to his God and his fellow men because he is usually quite charmed by the amount of astral debris he has accumulated in his atomic structure. The weight of the misqualified energy he is using places him under the delusion that the rioting forces within gives him power. He throws his weight around, as the popular saying goes. He likes to give orders, put people in their places, clamp down on this situation or that, and in general act like a big shot. If he happens to be a scientist seeking to ferret out the secrets of atomic power, he can only react according to the limitations he has imposed upon his own atomic structure. He therefore seeks to enslave the atom, just as he has enslaved his own atoms that he lives with each day. He can think of atomic power only in the terms of fission and fusion. He wants to split the atom, to tear it apart by brute force, to strip it bare as one would strip the skin off an orange. His way is the way of fear, of hate, of snickering smugness. The individual, who is not separated from his God by this barrier of astral debris within his body, seeks to become a co-worker, to serve his God. He daily works with the rays and the flames, which are only other names for the Christ truth. He forms a close friendship with the one whom he can trust, one who built this planet, with his Father. Knowing this truth, we become completely free. Our free minds then clearly see the glad reason for all this, and we then understand the cosmic ray. How different is the way of Jesus compared with the way of the fission-fusion scientists, for the way of Jesus is love. Yes, the true program for the Aquarian Age is the way of Christ Jesus, for true love is the greatest power, the only power, which will awe and defeat the atomic bomb. In the following chapters are set forth the broad outlines of the New Age program as it has manifested in recent years, and as it will affect the immediate future of every Earth person, indeed of every Earth atom. Since the program is in the final analysis, a scientific one, designed to prepare individuals for the future life, we will focus our attention first upon the vast preparatory work, which was started in 1856 by that great scientific genius, Nikola Tesla. According to the world at large, Tesla had strange ideas. He always thought he came from the planet Venus. He said as much to me, and the crew of a Venus spaceship said in one of their first messages, that a male child was born on board their ship during its trip from Venus to Earth in July, 1856. The little boy was called Nikola, which is the name of his family town, in reverse, on Venus. That is the town of Alokin. The ship landed at midnight, between July 9th and 10th, in a remote mountain province in what is now Yugoslavia. There, according to arrangements, the child was placed in the care of a good man and his wife. This message was first received by Arthur Matthews of Lakeport, Quebec, Canada, an electrical engineer who from boyhood was closely associated with Tesla. In 1944, a year after the death of Tesla, the late John J. Zeronel, then science editor of the New York Herald Tribune, wrote an excellent story of Tesla's life and work, entitled Prodigal Genius. O'Neill made the common error of assuming that Tesla had died and left no disciples. O'Neill could not have been more mistaken. In the first place, Tesla was not a mortal according to Earth standards. His thinking and his work was several hundred years ahead of Earth standards. Years before he died, he entrusted Arthur Matthews, of Canada, with many tasks, which are of vital current interest. To name two, the Tesla Interplanetary Communication System and the Anti-War Machine. Mr. Matthews built a model Tesla set which is named the Teslascope in 1938. This was designed after the first model, which Tesla built, with Matthews in 1917, during the First World War. This is a very simple machine, operated by the use of cosmic rays. Other models were built by Matthews in 1948, and a more recent model in 1967. The original design was given to Matthews by Tesla, and experiments were made with this receiver by Tesla with the help of Matthews, during the First World War. That is between 1917 and 1920. There were experiments also, with what is now known as radar, on the beach at Tadoussac, between that small town and along the beach to Rivière-Portneuf. Both towns are on the north side of the Great St. Lawrence River. At this spot, the river is about 22 miles wide, from north to south. Experiments were also made between both sides of the river with radar and the special receiver. After experimenting at this place, work was extended to Lake St. John at a private camp, located near Lake Edward, owned at that time by Major Henry Sanford, of New York City, a personal friend of Tesla and Matthews. A complete electrical laboratory was built at Sanford by the Major, and in this well-equipped shop was first developed radar and micro-waves. A third model of the Teslascope was also built here. During this time, between the years 1922 until 1930, we were able to keep in touch with Tesla at New York, by means of direct contact with microwaves, waves of less than 1 degree. The complete transmitter was built into a case only 3x2x2. This was battery operated, using the Tesla Mercury cell, and was a complete telephone, something much like the modern walkie-talkie. Some years after the above experiments, Arthur Matthews obtained the old farm at Lakeport. It was on this spot that the first practical radar was developed and built, from the working knowledge obtained from our experiment at Tadoussac. A number of other ideas of Tesla were also developed. One of these was a large air core transformer. A very high voltage developed by this was used for a guide station. It generated a standing beam which Tesla said extended directly upwards for a distance of about 30,000 miles. It was thus used as a guide for the spacecraft which Tesla expected would land on my property, sometime. It was due to this marker that the Venus ship has always landed at the exact same position. Not by a lucky chance, but pure design. Now before we go further into that, let us review a bit about the early life of Tesla, and by doing so try to clear up many mistakes some writers have made. The following is from the words of Tesla himself as told to Arthur Matthews between the years 1917 and 1943. Much of this was recorded on the Tesla High Frequency Voice Recorder. This is something like the well-known tape recorder, but it does not use any form of tape or wire, nor does it have any moving parts. Two historians agree that Nikola Tesla was born at midnight, between July 9th and 10th, in the year 1856. Duka Tesla, the mother, was a most remarkable woman and assuredly possessed advanced spiritual powers. She was the eldest child in a family of seven children. Lucky number seven. Her father was a minister of the Serbian Orthodox Church. Her mother became blind after the seventh child was born, and Duka unhesitatingly took charge of the entire household. She never attended school, nor did she learn even the rudiments of reading and writing, at home. Yet she moved with ease in cultured circles, as did her family. Here was a woman who could neither read nor write, yet she possessed literary abilities far beyond those of a person of considerable education. Tesla himself never wearied of talking about his remarkable mother, and described how she had absorbed by ear all the cultural riches of her community and her nation. Like Nicola, she apparently had the power of instant recall. Nicola said that she could easily repeat thousands of verses of the national poetry of the country. It was because of her great interest in poetry that Nicola, in his busy American days as a superman, still found time to translate and have published some of the best examples of Serbian sagas. His mother was also famed throughout her home provinces for her artistic ability, often expressed in beautiful needlework. She possessed remarkable manual dexterity, and Nicola said her fingers were so sensitive that she could tie 3 knots in an eyelash, even when she was past 60 years of age. She had an excellent grasp of philosophy and apparently a practical understanding of mechanical and technical devices. She needed a loom for household weaving, so she designed and built one. She did not think of herself as an inventor, yet she built many labor-saving devices and instruments for her household. In addition, she was so skillful in handling business and financial matters that she managed all accounts for her household well as for her husband's church. Nicola's father was the son of an army officer, and as a young man set out on a military career. But he was soon disillusioned, for he was irked by the discipline, and turned to his true calling in the literary field. He wrote poetry, articles on current problems, and philosophical essays. This led quite naturally to the ministry, giving him an opportunity to write sermons and to speak from the pulpit. He did not limit himself to the usual church topics, but ranged far and wide, covering subjects of local and national interest concerning labor, social and economic problems. Until Nicola was 7 years of age, the father had a parish church at Smilagen, an agricultural community in a high plateau region in that part of the Alps which stretch from Switzerland to Greece. This then was the childhood environment of the boy from Venus. It was a life filled with joy. He had an ideal home with a loving, understanding family. He lived in a magnificent countryside, close to nature. He was a boy like other little boys up to a certain point, the point at which he became the Superboy, foreshadowing the Superman. And so it was that he lacked human companions, a state, not of loneliness, but of aloneness that was to continue for a long time. He chose his friends with a wisdom we see in few humans. He had the deep, set piercing eyes of the thinker. Deep blue in color, they were honest, kind eyes, for he was an honest man, and whatever you are shows in your eyes, for they are the reflection of your soul. In my story, I will only state that which I know and try to enlighten those who have perhaps been deceived by reading untrue stories about Tesla. The powers possessed by him were in no sense psychic powers. The ability to visualize unthought of things, new things, and mold them into something real, such as the motors, and other wonderful things, as did Tesla, has nothing to do with the astral plane. For when Tesla wanted something, he went straight to God. Nothing complicated about his approach, for God is the only author of science and invention. The ability to visualize comes from training. Anyone, without any formal education, can talk to God, but it needs a bit of something more to listen when God speaks. A person who knows and loves God possesses powers which enable him to stand on this earth and yet observe incidents on Venus, Mars or the Moon. He can also look out over the earth and sweep the entire scene with one glance. He can look through the earth and watch activities within the dense physical globe. Thus it will be realized that the person who truly loves God is completely free. He can see above, as below. The person with astral vision is a prisoner of his own limited and highly questionable power. Peace of mind and serenity of soul do not lie along that route, nor can the voice of the silence be heard within the beating heart of the unlighted ones who amuse themselves with such nonsense. Astral vision is more often a sign of regression than advancement, for it simply denotes the attainment of certain animal characteristics. It must be remembered that all animals in certain advanced groups, dogs, cats, horses and elephants, have astral vision. Many other animals also possess it, and most animals are telepathic within certain limits. In humans, this type of clairvoyance is often associated with solar plexus telepathy, another animal characteristic. Many persons who use solar plexus telepathy are inclined to confuse it with mental telepathy, and those who practice mental telepathy are frequently unaware that the only type of telepathy which can be considered as spiritual power is from soul to soul. That is, two persons completely in tune with each other, or in tune with divine will, or spirit. Chapter 1, Part 3. Individuals who strive to cultivate their astral abilities, even though they may be born with them, are following an extremely dangerous course. One which can easily lead from psychism to black magic and from black magic to insanity. If an individual is born with psychic powers, he should either banish them at all costs, or take up the proper study which will enable him to serve God to the limit of his capability. These are thoughts which, if properly channeled, can lead to discipleship, but if not properly channeled, they can and will lead to mediumship and misery. Mediumship is the way of retrogression. Discipleship is the way to the path of truth, light, beauty, and unlimited cosmic freedom. Every individual has only one rule to follow, and this is it: place yourself at all times under the full power and protection of divine mind. There is no need to be running around the world searching for a guru or master. When you are ready to be of service to your maker, I will seek you. Tesla discovered this truth at an early age. His study of the Bible enabled him to conceive 1,200 inventions, and so the part he was to play in the divine plan unfolded quickly. He enrolled at the gymnasium at Gospic, a town to which his father had been assigned as a minister. Here Tesla discovered that his favorite subjects were the Bible and mathematics. In the school at Gospic, Nikola first came to desire to retain his ability to visualize real things, which could be used then, and in the future. From the study of such an old book as the Bible, which had been written thousands of years before he was born, he desired to bring this gift under full control and use it as a tool, rather than allow it to use him. Nikola had no wish to be submerged in paperwork, even in his school days, a thought which might be of value to many business and government executives today. Nikola found that he did not need to go to the blackboard in the classroom to work out a problem. At the thought of a blackboard, it would appear in the ether before him. As the problem was stated, it appeared instantly on the etheric blackboard, together with all the symbols and operations required to work out the solution. Each step appeared instantly and much more rapidly than anyone could possibly work out the problem on paper or slate. Therefore, by the time the whole problem had been stated, Nikola could give the solution immediately. At first, his teachers thought he was just an extremely clever boy who had found some method of cheating. However, in a short time they were forced to admit that no deception could possibly be practiced, so they gladly accepted the glamour shed abroad as the rumor got around that the Gospic classroom was graced by a genius. Nikola never bothered to explain about the etheric blackboard, for he intuitively knew he would not be believed. Always through the passing years, he guarded his power as the great spiritual treasure he knew it to be. He used the same power to replace all customary memory functions, and soon he discovered that he could learn foreign languages with little of the usual effort. He became proficient in German, French, and Italian in those early years, and this opened up to him entire new worlds that remained closed to other students. His father's library contained hundreds of fine books, and by the time Nikola was 11 years old, he had read them all. He had little in common with his schoolmates, and, in fact, little in common with his teachers. But they accepted him because he was a lovable lad without a trace of arrogance or pride. Neither did he surround himself in an exaggerated sense of humility. He was a normal, natural, friendly boy living in a natural, friendly world. On fine summer days, he would often wander over the mountains to sit again beside the brook at Smilijin, and watch his little water wheel in operation, the wheel he had designed and installed. He was constantly working on mechanical devices during the year he was in school at Gospic, but the school offered no courses that could help him, not even a course in manual training. In his home hung a picture which he had often carefully studied. His uncle explained that it was a picture of Niagara Falls in America. Filled with prophetic joy, he exultantly turned to his uncle and said, "Someday I am going to America and harness Niagara Falls for power." 30 years later, He carried out his plan, exactly as he had predicted it at the age of 10 years. Chapter 3. In the book, Return of the Dove by Margaret Storm, mention is made of the Wall of Light. Many mistaken ideas have come from that story. It was Tesla who conceived the idea of the Wall of Light during his early life.